King Arthur, have you heard about that character? Guess what? He's proof of your Hebrew roots. He surely is. Really? You'll see. Whoops. Who was this guy? Where did he come from? When did he live? Real or imaginary? Lots and lots and lots of books about him, and musicals, TV series, movies. Some of the movies very good, some of them pornographic and filthy. There's even King Arthur Flower. One of the best flowers named after him. One of the tallest trees in the world named after King Arthur. Well, King Arthur the Mystery. Norma Goodrich, a historian writing about him, said, "Certainly no other hero of the Dark Ages figures so preeminently in such a vast body of world literature as does King Arthur." They, speaking of ancient historians, were every bit as interested and passionately involved in their endeavor to find the true King Arthur as we are in ours. And get this, and not a few of them devoted their lives to it. Can you imagine historians devoting their lives trying to figure out who this character is? From this documentary, never has there been a figure as magnetically attractive as that of King Arthur. Never. Scratch beneath the surface of the legend and there are clues revealing a man, not a myth. What was he known for? A man of valor, a warrior who became a king, his knights, a round table, a sword, a stone, an adulterous woman. What was her name? Guinevere. His spiritual advisor, Merlin. In the belief of many, he was a medieval king of England. You ask him, well, hey, was he real or imaginary? Most of them say, I'm not sure. Well, a legend or a myth? What is a legend or a myth? A legend is an unverifiable popular story handed down from earlier times. And I would ask, who handed this thing down, this legend? And where and what were the earlier times? A myth is defined as any real or fictional story, one of the fictions or half-truths forming part of the ideology of a society. Let's take an example. Let's say the number one represents a known fact. I mean, this is true, number one. Number two is an embellishment. An embellishment adding fanciful details to. I went fishing, I caught a fish, he's this long. But by the time I finish embellishing that fish, he's about that long. Is there some truth in that? Yeah, and some embellishment. 1 + 2 = 3, i.e., a legend, a myth, some fact, some fanciful fiction by the time it reaches a point. Now, I think an example is the sword and the stone. You remember, who can pull the sword out of the stone becomes the king. That's an embellishment, but I believe there really was a sword and a stone involved in this legend. So, who was King Arthur? Where did the legend come from? And what do most people say when asked these questions? But what do the professional historians say? Well, the professionals, most of them are going to say, it came from the Celtic migrations. That's the way the legend came to England, Europe. Celtic in migration. But, lo and behold, in the year 2000, Scott Littleton and Linda Malcor come out with their book, Hey Guys, You're Wrong. This legend originated in Scythia and then went to England and Europe. Right there, there's the migration. Well, where were the Scythians living? from about 700 B.C. to about 200 or 300 A.D. They were in the southern steppes of modern-day Russia, north of modern-day of the land of Israel, just right north of the Black Sea, Scythians. And there's a movie based upon that very book, this very premise right here. And according to Archaeology Magazine of May, June 2005, they've got some pretty good evidence. They claim in the movie it's based on a true story. Well, they've got some pretty good evidence that it is indeed. The legend of King Arthur came from the land of the Scythians. But then, lo and behold, in the year 2004, here comes Graham Anderson with his book out. And he says, hey guys, Grant, the legend of King Arthur existed in antiquity, before the time of Christ. Graham Anderson, he's not a dummy. He's a professor of classics, University of Kent in Great Britain. And he concludes, hey, the legend came from Greece, modern day Greece, before the time of Christ. So we have three possibilities as to how the legend reached England and Europe. So my question, who's correct? Well, could it be they are all correct? Oh my. How is that possible? Well, guess what? John Francis Campbell, a historian, a prolific writer of the 1800s, concludes that the Celts, and there's much debate about where the Celts came from, but I agree with him that they came from, you know why? Because he agrees with me. He says they came from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, which would put us back here in this area somewhere here, eastern shores of the Mediterranean. Then there is interesting correspondence, and this is reported by Steve Collins in his books, and it's reported by Josephus, between King Arius of Sparta and Onias, a high priest back in Jerusalem, around the year 300 or 400 B.C. And the correspondence is something to the effect, hey, guess what, we're kinfolks. Now, they don't say we're fellow Jews, but they say in the correspondence, we both descended from Abraham. So here are these Greeks saying we descended from Abraham. And based on John 7, 35 and 36, there's an interesting precept here. The Jews therefore said to one another, where does this man, Yahshua, intend to go that we shall not find him? He's not intending to go to the dispersion, a term applied to the 10 tribes, among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? And then, Anne Christensen, writing for the Royal Danish Academy of Sciences and Letters, back in the 1980s, pins it down. Now, there were several tribes of these Scythians, one of whom were the Sumerians. Sumerians. And her conclusion? Hey, guys, it's simple. The Sumerians were, in fact, identical with who? The Israelites deported from northern Israel, where their capital was what? Samaria. Just spelled a different way, pronunciation's the same, after the fall of Samaria in 722 B.C. That's who those characters were. So, who is correct? Well, every source points right back to where? Back to Israel. So now our triangle, our map is complete. The migrations came to England via Israel. So, who is King Arthur? A man of valor, a warrior who became a king, a table, a stone, a sword, a grail, or a cup, knights, adultery within the kingdom, a spiritual advisor, 12 battles, one of which was a civil war. This is all part of the King Arthur legend, a bear, a cart, a giant killer. Who is he? That's in Rome, King David. Yep. Yes, indeed. A man of valor, a warrior, who took on Goliath when no others dared to do so. A warrior who later became a king when? After the death of that father-in-law of his. a king who had a table at which honored knights and men would sit. You can read about in 2 Samuel 9. This is interesting. Out of the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, they don't realize where they're going. They don't have any further discussion, but discussing David's mighty men, they say these were the knights of David's round table. Abishai, one of the knights, according to Kiel and Delicetz, however you pronounce that commentary on the Old Testament, he was the chief of the three, of which we find in Samuel 5:18, i.e. chief of the bodyguards, or knights, they conclude. Adam Clark's commentary. I'd been sharing these things that I was finding over this time with my sons and daughters-in-law. And they were saying something to the effect, "Now, Papa, are you sure about this? You sure you hadn't gone off the dark, the deep end?" And then I found this in the life, discussing the life and character of David. Again, these guys don't completely come to the conclusion, but they're getting mighty close. He had a company of companions, of champions, or as they are generally termed, worthies or mighty men, to the number of 37. The account given of these, speaking of 2 Samuel 23, would almost render credible the legend of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. I submit it not only almost does, it does. And it is probable that the first ideal of that ancient romance was taken from the genuine history of David and his 37 champions. And a stone, but the stone with which he brought down who? A sword with which he took from the fallen Goliath. A giant killer, that's part of the King Arthur legend. Graham Anderson talks about it on page 135 of his book. Well, that's David, 1 Samuel 17. A cup or a grail. That's part of the King Arthur legend for sure. You know about that. Well, hey, Yahweh is my cup. My cup runneth over. A warrior who presented the head of the enemy to his king. King Arthur did. Well, guess what? King David did too. So when David, out of 1 Samuel 17, returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. How about some more? A man who is said to have single-handedly killed a large number of the enemy. That's part of the history of King Arthur. Well, out of 1 Samuel 18, the women were singing, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. A man who spared an unyielding enemy. King Arthur did, discussed by Graham Anderson, page 130. Who had an unyielding enemy on his back from the get-go? And spared him how many times? At least two. Had him in the cave, he could have killed him then, and then sleeping in the camp, and he spared him both times. And even more. A spiritual advisor, Merlin. Merlin had long hair and was an old man. The prophet Samuel had what? Because he was a Nazarite. And he was old during the time of King David. A bear, part of the King Arthur legend. Well, David killed a bear while tending his father's sheep. I don't need all that armor. He told King Saul, I can handle this. At Philistine. An adulterous woman. Who was she? Now, wait a minute, Roger. Wait a minute. In the legend, it's Lancelot, the foreigner, making off with Guinevere, the wife of the king. But in the King David situation, it's King David making off with the wife of Uriah the Hittite, the foreigner. Something's wrong. No, let's just take some facts, but embellish it a little bit, because we can't have our hero being the villain. See how that came about? The youngest son taking over the kingdom. Graham Anderson talks about that on page 87. Well, who was the youngest son of the seven? King David. King David. Who administered justice and righteousness. Well, David did too. You can read about it in 2 Samuel 8. A king who had an errant son. In the legend, it's Mordred. But in reality, who was it?
Absalom.
Now get this. A warrior who fought 12 battles, one of which was a civil war. Guess what Brother Roger did when he saw that? He got his Bible out and started counting the battles. Guess how many I found? 12, one of which was a civil war. And it's in your handout I have for you later here. The civil war was with who? Absalom. Yeah. And he was blessed. Well, a man who was blessed. The Taliesin poem speaks of that. And according to 1 Samuel 23 and right on through, David was just blessed coming and going, up one side and down the other. And now it has pleased you to bless the house of your servant, David says, that it may continue forever before you. For you, O Yahweh, have blessed, and it is blessed forever. A man who is not morally impeccable. King Arthur was not. Well, guess what? King David wasn't either, was he? Bathsheba, Uriah the Hittite. A king who made a cart. That's part of the King Arthur legend. Well, who evidently had a cart made to carry an ark? Got somebody in trouble? A wine and banquet provider. King David was too. And still more. A king who even in his later life was still having rebellion within the kingdom and fighting among his knights. Was King David also? Yeah. Now this is great right here. King Arthur was a bard. What is a bard? A poet. You know, would sing poetry, etc. Well, I went and looked up the root word of bard. I looked up the word and then the root word, and it means one who praises. Who praised Yahweh more than anybody in the Psalms? A king who will return. That's part of the King Arthur legend. Who will in the future return, rule, and reign. But they shall serve Yahweh their God, and David their king, whom I will raise up for them. Jeremiah 30, verse 9. My servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd when the two sticks are restored, and they'll walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. That hasn't happened yet, but it's coming. It's on the horizon. It's coming. Rex quandam et futuris, out of this documentary.
The son said he did not die, and had gone to Avalon for the healing of his wounds. Others claimed he slept, waiting until his land had need of him. Then he would return. Rex quandam et futuris, the once and future king.
King David, our once and our future king after his resurrection. And there's a book, The Once and Future King, and there's your stone and the sword within it. King and Prince, Ezekiel 34, and I, Yahweh, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, Yahweh, have spoken. Well, as King Arthur was a prince, King David. In the last days, Hosea 3, afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek Yahweh their God and David their king. And they will come trembling before Yahweh and to his goodness in the last days. It's on the horizon. What about Camelot? How does Camelot fit into the tradition? Well, let's see what this fellow here has to say about Camelot.
Camelot represents good government. It represents an incorruptible system. It represents something that I think every politician, every king has aspired to. And I don't think we'll ever have it, to be honest with you. Someone might refer to Camelot as being a representation of utopia. And when you actually look at what that means, it means nowhere at all.
Camelot, a representation of utopia. You look up utopia in your dictionary, it means no place at all. Well, I was interviewed a few years ago by a BBC reporter on my sexual abstinence presentation, and I said, hey, I've seen and read where historians and archaeologists are over there looking for Camelot in England now, trying to find it. Is that correct? Yeah, she said. They're trying to find it now. Guess what, guys? They're not going to find it. Why? Because Camelot is what? Mount Zion. Great is Yahweh and greatly to be praised in the city of our God and His holy mountain, beautiful in elevation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the sides of the north, the city of the great King. For a day in thy courts is better than a thousand outside. I'd rather be a doorkeeper at the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. One thing I've asked from Yahweh that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life. Psalms 27, verse 4. Camelot had walls of silver. And silver represents what? Redemption, salvation. Kasef, you look up the root word, it means to become pale and to pine after. And again, what color do you grow when all the blood is draining out of your body while hanging on the cross? And pale. And then who pined after? Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I draw you to me as he pined after us? David accumulated 7,000 talents of silver, refined silver, according to 1 Chronicles 29, verses 3 through 4. And that's about 525 pounds to overlay the walls of the buildings of the temple. But you shall call your walls salvation, silver, and your gates praise, Isaiah 60:18. This came to me from a prisoner who saw my King Arthur and Lost Tribes presentation, a prisoner down in Florida. He wrote back with this letter. If the Holy Grail is not an actual, tangible, physical cup, but a spiritual concept, Psalm 16, etc., then would we not find the grail at every communion service or Passover Seder? Would not the cup that holds the symbolic blood of Yahshua be that holy grail, holy chalice? Thus, we can all find the holy grail, every one of us, if we look for it in the right place at the communion of bread and wine. Much as you said that we cannot find Camelot is because we're looking in the wrong place. It is, in fact, the city of David. We're all looking for, mankind ought to be looking for the Holy Grail. Now, here's something that will blow you away, too. Graham Anderson, in his book, says there's a star connection, regarding King Arthur. Now, he doesn't get into a whole lot of detail because I don't think he understands it. But this is interesting out of Psalms 89:37. It, speaking of David's throne, shall be established forever. And then here's this interesting statement. And the witness in the sky is faithful. There's some kind of witness up there in the sky. And it has something to do with David. Now, while we're going into this question, was one of David's mighty men, Mort, a black man? Can we take a shot at that and maybe see that he was? Let's look. 2 Samuel 23. Then three of the mighty, of the 30 chief men went down and came to David. And David was then in the stronghold. Now keep that in mind. He is in a stronghold while they were in war, in battle here. While the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David had a craving, we might say a wish, and said, "Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." So the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water from the well of Bethlehem, which was by the gate, and they took it and brought it to David. And continuing, "Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to Yahweh. And he said, 'Be it far from me, O Yahweh, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives?' Therefore, he would not drink it." Question. Were there three of these men? Yep. Were they three lucky dudes? You talk about lucky dudes. How long did it take them? We don't know. How did they do it? We don't know. I don't think they just simply ran over there in a 100-yard dash and ran back. I think there's more to it than that. When? Was it night? Was it daytime? Well, there just happens to be a constellation in the sky, the witness in the sky, of a man who is doing what? Pouring out a liquid, and it happens to be this fellow Aquarius. Now, you can go to most any bookstore and get books on stars and check on the stars and their names. And out of those books that I have there, they say of this constellation, it's a man or a boy pouring water from a bucket. And it speaks about some of the stars. The name of one of them means what? The camp with entrenched walls. And where was David? He's in a garrison. Well, and another star means the outpouring of wine. And does not wine picture blood? You guys have gone in jeopardy of your blood, of your lives. He poured it out like blood. Well, here's the names of the major stars. Sadal Malik. Malik. Does that sound like the Hebrew word Malik for king? And it just happens to mean lucky one of the king. Was he a lucky dude to do that and get back? One of the king. And the next one, Sadal Sud, means the luckiest of the lucky. That dude must have really been lucky. And then the third one, here's your third one out of the three. Lucky star of hidden things. This guy probably, I theorize, had to hide a little before he could get back. And then the fourth star, David had a what? Wish or craving. I find that utterly amazing. Now, one of these stars, luckiest of the lucky, and an oriental name evidently, means what? The black warrior. And who named the stars? Psalms 140, what, 7 or 8? Who named the stars? Yahweh. Yahweh gives them names. Did he do that just to be Whistling Dixie? No. And those names have meaning. I think we can make an argument based on Psalms 147:4, in fact, 4, that fact that Yahweh named them, that one of these warriors was a black man. I mean, they weren't that far away down in Africa. One of his knights. So the two lost kingdoms, Camelot, lost. Israel, the northern 10 tribes, lost. But hey, what brought them both down in the legend and what we know? A three-letter word called what? Sin. But get this. What is coming? What's on the horizon? In the legend of King Arthur, the once and future king who's going to be restored to his land when his land has need of him, and the 10 lost tribes are going to be what? Restored. But what about the name, Roger? Well, I got to thinking about that. How did it come? How did it move from David to Arthur? And I concluded, you know what? I think Yahweh gave me this thought. It's not a name. It's a title. It's a title. Or Armageddon, high place, Thur, relating to the Teutonic word for king, a ruler. High king or high ruler. Concluded, Arthur is a title. 1 month later, Yahweh sent this book across my path confirming that by Graham Phillips and Martin Keatman, and they concluded in their book, King Arthur, The True Story, yeah, it's not a name, it's a title. Arthur in the name books, a favorite name of puzzling origin. It may be safely interpreted as valorous. Well, hey, there's our warrior valor. Since its Welsh form, bear man, there's your bear, David killed the bear, suggests bravery, and an old Celtic derivation, rock, there's your stone, suggests firmness. Yahweh's faithful word, out of 2 Samuel 7 and 9, 1 Chronicles 17, 8, and I will make you, David, a great name like the names of the great men who are on the earth. Guess what? He has. Mankind just hasn't come to realize it yet. Now, the big question. Who can connect the dots? Who carried the legend from the land of Israel across Europe to England in at least three migrations? Celtic, Greek, and Scythian. Now I'm going to ask you, who did it? Your forefathers, right? And I can give this presentation to service clubs and Sunday groups it's right over their head. They don't even start to get it. Don't even start to. But it's just evident. It's clear. Our forefathers did when migrating up to Europe, and then from Europe, on, of course, some of us came on over here and then spread out.
To the Caribbean and to America and to Australia and Canada.
All over, yeah. In conclusion, King Arthur, King David, or Yahshua, King Yahshua, our High King of Heaven, he's our victory one, Yahshua is. May we reach heaven's joys, Camelot's joys, via our vision, our ruler of all. And vision is defined as a person, or Yahshua, or thing, of extraordinary beauty. We should all be like these knights going to Camelot, searching for that Holy Grail. So you would think that's the end, except there happens to be a little P.S. Kids, guess what? It's about who? Jack and the Beanstalk. Jack the Giant Killer. You remember that story of Jack, don't you? His mom said, once upon a time, there was a boy who lived with his mother in a tiny cottage. They were very poor. One day his mother said to him, Jack, you must take our cow to the market and sell her so we can buy food. That's the last thing they had with which to buy food, and then they were going to starve to death. Well, on the way to market, Jack set out, and on the way he met an old man. That's a fine-looking cow, said the old man. If you'll give her to me, I'll give you some magic beans. Jack stared at the red and yellow beans. How exciting. He took the beans and said goodbye to his cow, then hurried back home. Jack's mother was very angry when she saw what he had done. Silly boy, she exclaimed. Now we shall starve. She threw the beans out the window and said, go to bed. When Jack awoke the next morning, his bedroom was dark. Shade was coming from somewhere. He ran to the window and saw a tremendously tall beanstalk outside. It seemed to reach up to the sky. They were magic beans, Jack shouted. He jumped out of the window and quickly climbed the beanstalk. At the top, he saw a beautiful castle sparkling in the sun. An old woman greeted him as he hopped off the ladder stalk and said, don't go near the castle, young man, she said. The wicked giant lives there. Long ago he stole your father's fortune and left him a poor man. Then I certainly must get it, Jack exclaimed as he strode right up to the castle door. The giant's wife answered the knock. If you want food, I'll give you some, she said, but you must hurry. My husband eats boys for breakfast. She gave Jack a slice of bread as big as a tabletop. But even as he ate, there came a great noise outside. Jack leaped into the skillet to hide. Kids, you see Jack hiding right there? Just as the giant entered, bellowing, fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread. He bent down and peered beneath the table. I smell boy. Nonsense, said his wife. Eat your breakfast. Grumbling, the giant sat down into 10 roasted oxen and 4 barrels of milk. Then he shouted, wife, bring me my magic hen. His wife hurried to obey. Lay, hen, lay, roared the giant. And the hen laid a golden egg. See that egg right there, kids? Very good, said the giant with a happy yawn. Soon he was sound asleep. And at the first snore, Jack popped out of the skillet, snatched up the hen, and ran off. When he had climbed down to the beanstalk, his mother grasped with wonder. Jack, she explained, it's your father's magic hen. The next day, Jack climbed the beanstalk again. "I'll give you a bite to eat," said the giant's wife when she saw him. "But hurry, the giant is in a terrible temper because he lost his magic hen." Well, Jack was eating a tart as big as a fish pond when the castle began to shake. He leaped into a butter churn. You see Jack hiding in the butter churn right there? As the giant entered, bellowing, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread." "Don't tell me you smell boy again," said the wife. "Sit down and eat your breakfast." Muttering to himself, the uncultured giant grabbed 12 roasted pigs and 6 dozen eggs. Then he shouted, "Wife, bring me my harp." Quickly, the wife did as she was told. "Play, harp, play," commanded the giant. And the harp played such beautiful music that it soon lulled the giant to sleep. At once, Jack jumped out of the butter churn, seized the harp, and ran away. When he reached the bottom of the beanstalk, his mother was waiting. "Oh, Jack," she said happily, "you found your father's golden harp." When Jack climbed the beanstalk the next morning, the giant's wife was waiting for him. "I'll give you a snack if you wish, she said, "but you are in great danger. The giant lost his harp yesterday, and he's in a terrible rage." Jack was eating a cupcake as big as a haystack when he heard the giant coming. He jumped into the pail to hide and listened to the terrible roar. "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread." "Sit down and eat your breakfast," said the giant's wife. "Then you'll feel better." Mumbling angrily, the giant ate 15 roasted ducklings and 200 sausages. "I told you he is not kosher." "Wife," he growled, "fetch my gold. That will cheer me up. For a long time, the giant played with his gold pieces. When at last he closed his eyes, Jack jumped out of the pail, snatched the gold, and ran. But the giant had been only pretending to sleep. With a roar, he leaped to his feet. "I told you I smell boy," he bellowed as he raced after Jack. And there goes Jack. Poor Jack ran faster than he'd ever run in his life. "Mama, get the axe ready," he shouted from the top of the beanstalk. He climbed down. As he climbed down, the beanstalk began to sway. Jack looked up and saw the giant was coming down too. It was such a frightening sight that Jack dropped the gold. He dropped all the way to the ground. Quick as a wink, he jumped up, grabbed the axe from his mother. Smack, smack, the beanstalk snapped in two. There was a giant crash, and the giant lay before them dead. Jack the giant killer. Jack's mother gave him a hug and told him he was indeed a brave boy. "You have brought back your father's hen, his harp, and his gold," she said. "We shall certainly live happily ever after. For who could be sad with a hen to lay golden eggs, a harp to play beautiful music, and gold to buy bread and cheese, and sometimes strawberry tarts?" Oh, boy. Well, guess what? According to the legend, King Arthur had a son. And Graham Anderson, pointing out on page 150 of his book, said King Arthur was associated with Jack the Giant Killer. And Jack gave him the gold which he took from the giant. That's part of the legend. So, King Arthur or King David had a son named who ended up with all the gold? Shlomo or Solomon. Yeah, we can read about it in 2 Chronicles 1, verse 15. And the king made silver and gold at Jerusalem as plenteous as stones. Jack, the name, is simply a contraction for Jacob. Jack's son means Jacob's sons or sons of Jacob. The beans, okay, somebody connect the beans where they come in. Scratch your head. Give it some thought. The magic beans. The lentils or legumes with which he purchased the birthright. The beanstalk. Okay, guys, where does the beanstalk come in? Yep, you got it. Jack saw the beanstalk leading it to the sky after awakening, so Jacob saw the ladder in a dream after awakening and realized it was the gate to heaven. Okay, the castle, a fortified city in the sky. Out of Deuteronomy 1, verse 28. Where can we go up? The 10 spies said. Our brethren have made our hearts melt, saying, the people are bigger and taller than we. Giants, in effect. The cities are large and fortified to heaven. And besides, we saw the sons of the Anakim, the giants there. Can't do it. Stole their faith. Who was the giant's wife that betrayed him? Yep. Like a harlot, betrayed. Hid Jack's sons from the giant, Rahab the harlot. The giant killer, the sons of Israel, or Jacob, who conquered the promised land and killed the who? Killed the giants. In fact, King David brought down one of them. The gold. Where'd the gold come from? Up in the sky, from heaven. So, Solomon, King Arthur's son, only asked for wisdom. But Yahweh was so impressed, he not only gave him wisdom, but abundant riches and honor. So it had to come from the sky, i.e. from Yahweh. I love this one right here. I love this one. Who is the old man? No. Who is the ancient old man? Jim got it. Out of Daniel chapter 7, verse 9, I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and his hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, and his wheels were a burning fire. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. Birthright blessings. Yahweh gave magic beans or birthright blessings to those who do what? Exchange, give, or sacrifice their what? Cow and the cow pitcher's flesh. Their very life to him. Young boy, you give me your very life and I'll give you these magic beans. You trust me and I'll trust you. Jack's mother said, so that we will not starve to death. Jack entrusted his very life to the old man, to Yahweh himself. And Yahweh, who created beings, so he had them to give, right? They were his, gave them to Jacob to receive the magic beans. Why? Well, trust. Jacob, or Jack, placed his trust, faith, and confidence in the old man, the Ancient of Days, and his word, so, therefore, Yahweh could entrust these blessings to him. What about the golden hen that laid the hen that laid the golden egg? Where does that fit in? Out of Zechariah 6, verse 14, there's a verse. And the crown shall be to Helam, and to Tobijah, and to Jedidiah, and to Hen, the son of Zephaniah. And Zephaniah means Yahweh's got a little secret for us here. Got something secreted for us, for a memorial. Are golden eggs unnatural? They are. Well, in the Hebrew, hen, or ken, is the word for what?
Grace,
kindness, and favor. And grace from the Almighty is unnatural to the natural man. Out of 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 14, but a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit, for they are foolishness to him. He cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 12, now we receive not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God. And that hen laid three golden eggs. And now you know the rest of the story, right? So what? What is the central point of the presentation? And this is what my Sunday friends can't get. It has to be spiritually revealed. What's the central point of the presentation? We're the offspring, and our ancestors brought this legend, these stories to us. Who are our ancestors? Yep, the lost tribes. Jewish? Probably not. Hebrew, Israelite? Yeah, we probably are. I submit we are. What difference does it make? Well, ask him. He'll tell you. Now, I have detailed slides that's not for the choir, you guys, but, you know, that I can show others. Hey, I'm speaking about you so-called Gentiles. I've got some unanswered questions. The golden harp, I don't know. That's bound to be in there. I know David had a harp, but I can't make the connection there. And the gold, I showed this a couple of weeks ago to a man and his wife, and I told her I didn't know, but I think she gave me something on this, that the gold picture's faith that was stolen. And the shield of faith, take up the shield of faith, you know. The old woman who met Jack at the top of the beanstalk and cautioned him, I don't know about that. Jack's mother, not sure. Well, hey, how? How did these legends, myths, and tales, and bedtime stories come about? I can see two possible ways. One way is some guys sat down around a table and started to come up with all this stuff. Hey, how are we going to make this work? I don't think that's what happened. I think it just kind of evolved or graduated over or came about over time as Yahweh would put a thought into the minds of these folks. That'd be my guess. Now, I have some handouts for you here that discuss these things and the 12 battles, etc. So feel free to take them. And here's these books. You can look over those if you want to. And here's something I ask of you. If Yahweh gives you more insight, like on the harp and music from heaven, etc., well, let me know. You know, we can all help out each other. And this is the end, really.